John Allen presents the Creepy Crawl Podcast.
Hey, creeps, welcome back to the Creepy Crawl Podcast. It's Big Daddy Cool, the straw that stirs the drink, John Allen. I am here with the case of the preppy killer or the preppy murder. And creeps, this was the story that turned me on to true crime some 29 years ago. Real quick, want to give a shout out to everyone who's been helping the show. You are sexy MFers. If you would like to be a sexy MFer as well, you can do so by going to patreon.com/creepycrawl. You can also go to Venmo at jonathan-allen-154. And as always, please follow me on Twitter. That handle is at writerjohnallen, no H, boy band spelling. This is where you'll see a lot of photos that really tie the story together, as well as my bullshit. Yep, I post bullshit on Twitter because it's Twitter. Research for today's episode occurred on April 4th, and on this day in history, today, it's Easter. That's right. Resurrection Sunday, or Easter, is a Christian festival and holiday commemorating the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Spooky. As described in the New Testament, having occurred on the third day after his burial following the famous crucifixion by the Romans. So, happy Easter to all my religious creeps. Easter is one of the few holidays that does not have a pop song like a Christmas or a Halloween. So for today, the imaginary intro music is going to be The Bunny Song by VeggieTales. I said no Halloween, but for some of you parents, this might give you nightmares. But you know what? Fuck it. Why not? Alright, I am excited to get right into it, gang. This was the case that started it all for me. This was the book. This was everything at the time. And Woodrow is passed out from his sugar high, so I finally have a moment of peace. So, grab your kiddos' Easter baskets, throw the disgusting peeps in the trash where they belong, and creepy crawl with me. So, creeps, the year is 1992. I am about 14 or 15, depending on the month, that much I can't remember. And I begin my first foray into true crime when I read the book Wasted, The Preppy Killer by Linda Wolf. This book actually came out in 1989, 3 years after the murder, and I found it somewhere in my parents' collection of books under a pile somewhere. It was a book I remember my father talking to me about, because in 1986, he was probably in his 30s, and this was really some high-profile stuff. It always intrigued him, and it intrigued me. You gotta think, 1986, preppies, the movie Wall Street is really kicking some ass there, you know, a year later on screen. So that was the New York vibe at the time. I know I read this in 1992 because I would always have the radio kind of on low while reading, and that song, If You Ask Me To, by Celine Dion, always seemed to play on Q102, which was the Cincinnati pop station. By the time I shut the book closed, after having read it in one sitting, as I tend to do with most books, I simply sat in silence and tried to absorb what I was feeling. This is a great testament to the author, Linda Wolf, because by the end, somehow, I knew Jennifer Levin. And in some hopeful and delusional fantasy, which I have to this day and always have because I'm a creative type, I could go back and save her from the detestable killer and the complicit tabloid media. Creeps, as you can obviously figure out, it was only a fantasy, of course. But I'll tell you, long before OJ and the rest with the Menendez and so forth, the Preppy Killer case was amongst the advent of the modern true crime genre as we know it from a consumer vantage. I think a lot of that began with In Cold Blood, and the Manson family really did a number on that as well. But by the time 1986 rolled around, we had a biased, opinion-based media, shock value, that sort of thing, and this put a new twist on such a major case. For me, it began a journey that I am still on, and quite frankly, it's one that I can never return from. So the Preppy Killer himself, Robert Chambers, was born on my dad's birthday, unfortunately, September 25th. Different year, though. He was born in the Big Apple in 1966. Chambers was the only child born to Phyllis Chambers and Robert Chambers Sr. Phyllis, who we'll grow to hate because she was a coddling Karen and just a terrible woman, was an immigrant who was born in Ireland. Robert Sr. worked for MCA Records, and he later worked in video cassette distribution, which I imagine is not a career that panned out too well for him. The family did live in Manhattan, but before that, they lived in Queens in a working-class area. They were not wealthy. New York Magazine reported that although the family was not wealthy, his mother in particular was determined that her son would be part of New York's elite circles. This is pretty common with people try to fake it till they make it. The type of people that buy a Rolls Royce but can't afford tires. It's a wannabe situation. I've never understood why anybody would want to be pretentious like that. For some reason, though, I don't know. Maybe Phyllis Chambers grew up poor in Ireland. She thought this was the American dream. It was the 80s. Robert Chambers himself, since he was a coddled little kid, was a pathetic, teat-suckling mama's boy who was Nerf ball soft. I despised him as I read the book back then. I think he's soft and kind of a pussy, even though he's a big guy. I thought it as a 15 or 14-year-old when I read the book in 92, and I'd spit in his eye and throat punch him if I saw him today. Again, his mother was a coddling enabler, the original Karen. She was so phony. She always tried to position her son outside of the family's actual social hierarchy or status. She arranged for him, for example, to have a play date with JFK Jr. I guess Phyllis Chambers, Robert's mother, had cared for JFK Jr. as a nurse when JFK Jr. was sick with bronchitis. During that time, she suggested, hey, maybe you and my son can go to a restaurant and a theater, because that's what rich kids want to do, right? They want to play in the theater? I think not. But this does happen. According to the woman who was Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis' assistant at the time, and presumably sort of in charge of JFK Jr., Robert Chambers' mother reportedly got upset, well, repeatedly, many times, with 5-year-old Robert for, quote, saying the wrong thing. Now think about that. 5 years old, when do you say the right thing? I'm 43 and I've yet to say the right thing. This goes to show you the tenacity and intention she had with being in these stupid, pretentious circles, the same pretentious circles that I destroy on my stand-up routine. I personally hate bullshit like that. But Robert Chambers was living the life. He attended private prep schools like York Prep, Choate, and Browning. By the time his parents had divorced, which was sort of around high school, he had free rein, which is not a good thing for a spoiled little bitch like that. Well, what did he do with his free rein, you ask, creeps? Well, he was soon expelled from all of those aforementioned schools. Again, while he'd gone to private schools and lived on the crusty Manhattan Upper East Side, Chambers' parents were not particularly wealthy. They did fake it. They got a maid they couldn't afford. But yes, Chambers, he attended these expensive prep schools with the help of scholarships and mostly greasing palms and connections. While Chambers's terrible mother sent her son to these private schools to help him make connections with wealthy and influential people, Chambers instead took advantage of those relationships and was known to routinely steal from his affluent friends while developing a substance abuse problem, most notably that white powdery line, words, that defined the 1980s, cocaína. Yep, in fact, just months before he strangled Jennifer Levin in Central Park, he stole his friend's credit card and racked up thousands of dollars in fraudulent charges. But Mommy Chambers convinced the victim not to press charges. I think this was a power move on the victim's part, kind of to show you, hey, I have fuck you money. Oh, your son did this and racked up thousands of dollars on my card. NBD. That's pocket change to me. This was the 80s. Again, this was preppy, 1986. This was the Wall Street era, the whole thing. Pop your collar, you know? And this event, of course, happened after Chambers had been kicked out of Boston University after just one semester. So if you haven't picked up on Robert Chambers, he was a big kid. He was a dumb fuck. If it was raining soup outside, he'd probably grab a fork. Robert Chambers was King Douche, Abercrombie and Bitch. He is the type of person that needs a Sharpie-drawn penis on his forehead that will never come off. Conversely, we have the victim, Jennifer Levin, who was considered to be a ray of sunshine to her family and friends. In contrast to the wannabes that was the Chambers family, Jennifer Levin actually lived in Manhattan all of her life with her father, who was a successful real estate agent, and her stepmother. She had attended the Baldwin School. This was an elite private school for girls. Jennifer Levin was also planning to go to college. She was very young when this happened. It actually happened the summer before college, which was a terrible thing. Her friend, a gal named Erica Lynn Huberty, wrote that Jen was a mixture of good and bad, but mostly was a sweet girl. Quote, she was a troublemaker who, on the whole, made little trouble. She was mischievous but kind, with a wicked sense of humor. So, basic chick, you know, basic nice girl, likes to have a little fun. She was a partier, but 18 years old? Boy, so was I. But she wasn't evil. She was not somebody who invited malevolence nor gave it. Chambers and Jennifer Levin knew each other casually. They had met before through mutual friends and went on one or two or three dates, I should say, according to reports from the time. The key player was this bar called Dorian's Red Hand. This was a preppy hotspot that, quote, catered to the sons and daughters of the rich, according to the 48 Hours special on the murder. Dorian's Red Hand, kind of a gross place. The kids would either come up with the most ridiculous fake IDs or just not bother at all. As long as the bouncer knew what the family name was, that was all that mattered. The owners knew it, the bar staff knew it, whatever. It was sort of this gross place where you walk in if you're an adult and you see a bunch of teenagers and maybe 20-year-olds just sitting around drinking alcohol they can't handle and just being pretentious and acting like rich idiots. Just 90210 stuff, bullshit, whatever. But keep in mind, Dorian's Red Hand, which was shut down after all of the events, thankfully, is key to this case. So, it is August 26th of 1986. 18-year-old Jennifer Levin was happily college-bound. It's the summer before college, and Levin is celebrating her upcoming move to Boston with her close friends at Dorian's Red Hand when she saw 19-year-old Robert Chambers, who was not celebrating anything because he was a loser and did nothing with his life. They began talking and, at about 3:45 a.m., walked together towards Central Park, which was about 5 blocks away. This is according to New York Magazine. Nothing strange here. You got two young, horny kids, testosterone's flowing. They already knew each other. They're drunk. This is a scenario that runs itself out probably thousands of times a day, right? So nothing, no big deal there. They're both adults too, so you know what? Have sex with who you want to have sex with. Not a problem. But according to Chambers, he and Jennifer Levin went to Central Park to have sex, and at some point she used her underwear to bind his hands behind his back. However, Chambers claimed he became upset when she repeatedly squeezed his testicles. Quite frankly, I'm amazed she found them. Talk about a needle in a haystack. In response to this supposed pain, because again, he was a giant pussy and a grotesque carnival of mutated humanity, I want to tell you, Chambers was 6'5 and weighed 220, but as a response, he angrily reacted by knocking Jennifer Levin off of him and, according to his own words, hitting her in the throat with his arm. Jennifer Levin was 5'4 and 105 pounds. Robert Chambers is 6'5, 220. Keep that in mind. Jennifer immediately fell backward onto the ground. Chambers said he, quote, knew something was wrong, but like the coward that he is, he left the scene without attempting to revive Levin and did not call 911 to get the young woman medical attention. Again, this is shit-stained story because the tiny little girl is not alive to dissect it. It makes no sense because if all he did was have a reaction, you know, oh, pain, and, you know, I get it. Like, sometimes if somebody pinches you in that nervy area in the back of your arm, you might whip around and slap them or something. So he's kind of claiming he did this with sex, but if he did nothing intentionally, then why did he not call 911? So a cyclist finds Levin's body beneath this tree at about 6:15 a.m., but she was estimated to have died around 5:30 a.m. Police soon arrived. They tape off the crime scene where Levin's body was twisted and laying half naked in the park. That's the dignity that he gave her. She was badly bruised and had cuts all over her face. Her white tank top blouse was tied around her neck like a noose. And this was something that a medical examiner would testify at Chambers' trial. The trashy reprobate Chambers actually watched the police find Levin's body. That's right. He hung around the park for at least a good hour or so after she died. He hung out like a coward where he could keep an eye on this lifeless dead body beneath a tree and just watch the goings-on at Central Park. He didn't flee the scene. He literally sat on a wall not far from Jennifer Levin's fresh corpse until the cyclist noticed the 18-year-old's lifeless body. Again, same feeling I had back in 92. Robert Chambers can go straight to hell and stay there forever. When law enforcement and emergency services arrived at Central Park, Chambers again was still in the area, but he did not tell any of the officers that he knew Levin. Consequently, police told Chambers, as well as members of the public who were kind of surrounding the scene, kind of like rubberneckers do at a car crash, to leave. One Linda Fairstein, who was head of the sex crimes unit of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office at the time, told 48 Hours that Robert Chambers returned home at some point and took a nap because he's a soulless toilet goblin. I don't understand how you could take a nap after committing murder, but this is what sociopaths do. After learning Jennifer Levin's identity and discovering that she had been at Dorian's Red Hand shortly before she died, it wasn't difficult for police to figure things out. They questioned the patrons who had been at the bar with the teenager, and investigators quickly learned that Levin had left Dorian's Red Hand with Robert Chambers, so they went to his home to question him about any possible involvement in Jennifer Levin's death. This was sort of a routine thing. They were checking up on all leads, so this wasn't anything particularly out of the norm. They initially were looking for his help because, supposedly, he was Jennifer Levin's friend. This all changed when the detectives arrive and Sleepy Fuck gets up, and the detectives see deep, fresh, bloody scratches on both sides of Robert Chambers' face. Smart Boy told police that his cat scratched him because, as you know, cat owners, your cat takes great pleasure in making sure he or she gets both sides of your face. I think not. Obviously, officers were unconvinced by this bullshit story, so they decided to bring him in for questioning. Later, police would find more scratches on his chest, as well as a hand injury. He was such an idiot. He was not necessarily pinned. Like, the case wasn't solved. They just sort of cuffed him and took him in for the questioning. He's so stupid, though. While he's being walked out of his home in handcuffs, Chambers turned to his father and said, quote, "That fucking bitch, why didn't she leave me alone?" According to Linda Wolf, the great author who wrote about the case in the book I recommend, Wasted, The Preppy Murder. The medical examiner later determined that she had been strangled to death, not killed by a single blow to the throat, as Robert Chambers had claimed. Eventually, Chambers confessed to killing Jennifer Levin, but still denied strangling her for some reason, instead telling officers it was a case of rough sex gone wrong. Ugh. Remember how this strand of manure had the gall to call Levin a bitch while being arrested? Sadly, while Chambers may have been the first person to blame Jennifer Levin for her death, he was hardly the last. Before slut-shaming was a widely discussed concept, before Me Too and everything, Jennifer Levin was slut-shamed by America, and this mostly culminated out of the core nerve center of media that is New York. Essentially, she was blamed for her own murder. Again, I'm going to put some of those headlines on my Twitter at writerjohnallen, no H, so you can see that this was a real thing. 1986 was not that long ago, and these headlines, they went on until 1989. So, yeah, it's hard to say, but this is a young woman, college-bound, happy, no issues, partied a little bit, but whatever. That's not a big deal. Who cares if she's even having sex, but she was slut-shamed by the media, who largely saw her as complicit in her own death. This disgusting New York press referred to Jennifer Levin's journal as her, quote, sex diary, because according to Robert Chambers' defense attorney, it included details of, quote, kinky and aggressive sexual activity by Jennifer Levin with many lovers. Here's the thing, creeps. It did not. None of that. Then the defense began calling her Jenny. This was something no one else did. Jenny is a name that sounds more freewheeling, I guess, than the more conservative Jennifer, which was her name. Of course, the New York press jumps right on top of this and joins in as well, calling her Jenny. This is not her name. I just don't understand it. It's like if someone just started calling me Bob or something. It does not fit. A New York Post headline had the nerve to run a headline again on my Twitter, reading, quote, "Jenny killed in wild sex," with a subheadline saying, quote, "The grief of his parents." There was even an article about how Jennifer Levin, who had been strangled by a man who weighed twice as much as her, should be blamed for her own murder in a piece titled "How Jennifer Courted Death." It's fucking unbelievable, reprehensive, irresponsible. I certainly hope none of these people work in journalism now. And as far as the people that do work in journalism that have good intent, these are the people to blame for why nobody trusts the media anymore. It's funny you hear about fake news, but this actually was fake news. It's almost as if this preppy boys club in the media decided to defend one of their own. It's disgusting. Throughout the trial, Robert Chambers' defense attorney attempted to slut-shame Jennifer Levin as this promiscuous young woman who was somehow to blame for her own death. What followed was a media firestorm and public court of opinion that would go unrivaled for years. Facing a second-degree murder charge for some reason, I'm not sure why it wasn't first degree, because it was murder, Robert Chambers' trial spanned 13 weeks. He and his, I guess they say, model-esque good looks made for compelling cover stories, sort of like Ted Bundy a decade prior. I don't know. I don't see it. I get that he's got this big frame and, you know, the jawline. He's got like a young Donald Trump look to him, though. I don't see where he's a model. He's just got a long face. He looks like a fucking mentally disabled horse to me, but whatever. They thought he was attractive. The media did. Jennifer Levin, of course, did not fare as well in the press. The misogynistic media at the time painted the murdered teen as a dominatrix in the press. And as mentioned, she was slut-shamed and accused of keeping the aforementioned sex diary, which didn't exist. What she actually had, creeps, was a book with dates and times she was meeting with friends, male or female, but there was no evidence it had anything to do with her sex life. Never mind the fact that it wouldn't matter anyway, as she was a murder victim. Again, she could have been a prostitute if she wanted to be. It still wouldn't matter. That's not what's on trial here. Being sexually active, if she even was, because this book leads to no details towards that, is not a crime or a reason to be killed. Again, this was actual fake news that began the downward spiral of print media in America. Basically, it became a cesspool of victim shaming and reaffirming the existence of that aforementioned boys' club. The real Jennifer was a picture of a quirky, fun-loving, very stylish teenager who preferred the excitement of the grittier side of New York, you know, 80s Manhattan, that proto-hipster lore. Of course, she chose to live with her father in his Soho apartment through high school. Duh, who wouldn't? But she was socially drawn to the Upper East Side. She had made a circle of friends who all attended New York's elite prep schools. She was a popular girl who would fit in everywhere. Unfortunately, as fate would have it, she managed to fit in an hour of her life into that of Robert Chambers. Sorry, creeps, I had to clear my throat there. I went to the beach the other day and got a massive, massive sunburn. And I've been kind of sick ever since, but this episode must go on. But, you know, you'd think Chambers would be humbled by now. But the prick kept up appearances in the land of criminal assholery and creepitude. Remember, he roamed free for nearly 2 years while awaiting trial. After killing Jennifer Levin, this idiot was convicted of committing a number of burglaries, stealing approximately $70,000 from penthouses on the Upper East Side. It's alleged that Chambers committed these burglaries, petty thefts, and credit card fraud to pay for his cocaine habit. I just wonder why he wasn't being drug tested, monitored. Again, it goes back to the boys club. I'm going to clear my throat again because it's about time. It's about time to destroy Robert Chambers. And it looks like Woodrow's waking up from his sugar nap. So here it comes. Well, creeps, Woodrow just woke up from his sugar coma.
I told you not to eat so many jelly beans. This is going to be like that time you got stuck on that carousel at the Utah State Fair while wearing roller skates. Remember that? Everything was moving, but you were just in place. Firefighters have more important things to tend to, bro.
All right, it's time for the Woodrow Comedy Minute. That always lasts way longer than a minute.
What's on tap today, I wonder? You know what? Just hand it over. I'm all in without judgment. I mean, it's Easter, no judging here.
Okay, creeps.
Oh, it looks like a Robert Chambers special. Good, because if you're like me, we hate this prick.
So, joke number one. What's the difference between a porcupine and Robert Chambers' prison cell? For the porcupine, the prick's on the outside.
Ah, love it, Woodsy.
Joke number two. Robert Chambers, murder supporting, morally bankrupt ex, asked me to help her use a screwdriver. I was surprised, as she's normally good at screwing tools.
Yeah, he was a tool.
Joke three. Well, this is, it's explicit, but deserved, creeps. If you're sensitive, just fast forward. So, this is Woodrow's joke three. When Robert Chambers gets to hell, there's a row of giant demons with 18-inch manhoods. A malevolent voice says, "Please proceed forward. Stop at every demon. When you get to the end, you will be judged." So Robert Chambers goes to the first demon, who proceeds to force itself on the murdering twat. After doing the deed, the demon then punches him in the face when it's over. Robert Chambers proceeds to go to the next demon, who does the same, and then punches him in the face. Robert Chambers can't decide what's worse, the violation or getting punched in the face right after. So the coward says out loud, "I do not deserve this." This is only met with silence. So he continues. He proceeds to go to each and every demon who continue to do the act before finishing off with a punch to the face. Once he gets to the end, Satan is wearing a judge's robe and says, "Robert Chambers, you're a real loser. Stealing and killing women for pleasure. You are a waste of space. I've made my judgment. You will walk up that same row of demons on the hour for all of eternity. Because your life was a sad joke. And that over there," he points to the row of demons, "is the fucking punchline."
Ah, bullseye. Great job, Woody.
I hope Chambers does indeed exist in this barren, evil wasteland one day. Great job, co-host. Creeps, that's our Woodrow. Now, back to the show. The trial of Robert Chambers began on January 4th of 1988 and it lasted approximately 3 months. This is funny to me. Part of Chambers' character defense was drawn from his childhood as an altar boy. Oh, that was one thing they also tried to do in the media, because Levin was Jewish and Chambers was Catholic. They tried to make that a thing too, which is, I don't understand that at all. Doesn't seem to me like Chambers practiced any type of religion, but anyway. So as a child, as an altar boy, Theodore McCarrick, a Catholic cardinal who at the time was the Archbishop of Newark, New Jersey, penned a letter lobbying for Chambers to be released on bond. Well, isn't that interesting? Creeps, you might remember that name. McCarrick, Father McCarrick, was defrocked in February of 2019 after at least 7 men alleged that he had sexually abused them as children. Well, Chambers, you are the company you keep. There was this whole thing in later years, actually I guess last year, sort of in Chambers' defense, oh well, Chambers was probably one of the altar boys that was affected by this, and that made him the monster that he was. Bullshit. You know what? When Bruce Wayne was a child, he saw his parents murdered. Did he go out and murder other kids' parents? Nope. He fucking became Batman. So, yep. Striking that motion down. There's my gavel. Bang, bang. The jury deliberated for 9 days, but they were unable to reach a unanimous verdict. Fuck that jury. Scrape their eyeballs out with a rusty spoon. I hope they are entombed in a vessel of shame for eternity. As it shakes out, in the end, Robert Chambers accepted a plea bargain which required him to plead guilty to first-degree manslaughter, and he was sentenced to, 15 years in prison. Unfortunately, the media wasn't put on trial, which is fucking ridiculous. Because without that media, maybe, I don't know, Jennifer Levin would have been treated as a human being. It gets worse. Shortly after Robert Chambers went to jail, a videotape, which had been taken shortly after he was charged with the murder back in 86, was leaked to the press. In it, he was surrounded by, we'll say, scantily dressed women, including his girlfriend, 19-year-old Sean Covell, who I guess the first joke Woodrow told would make more sense if you know about Sean Covell. But anyway, he's around these women in this videotape, which you can see anywhere. He looks at the camera with his fat, smug face, and he twists the neck of a Barbie doll, and he mocks a strangulation. And then in a falsetto voice, he says, "My name is," while twisting the doll's head, and kind of alludes to Jennifer Levin. What is wrong with this girlfriend he suddenly had after murdering Jennifer Levin, this 19-year-old Sean Covell at the time? New York City, Gotham, it's a big fucking place. This is who she chose in all of New York City. After Jennifer Levin's sister, Danielle Levin Roberts, viewed the videotape, in which, of course, as mentioned, it appeared as though Chambers was mocking Jennifer's death, Levin's sister Danielle told the media, quote, "He's not even a person, he's an animal." You are right about that, Danielle. He's an animal I just created. A detestable, abhorrent, abomination hybrid of a sickly pig and a mentally challenged ferret. I fucking hate this guy. In 1988, Jennifer Levin's parents filed a wrongful death suit against Robert Chambers, and they sought $25 million in damages. Chambers pleaded no contest to the charges because these civil suits always, like the OJ thing, they always end up, the truth seems to be set free during the civil suit, never the actual murder trial, which is weird and quite sad. But Chambers pled guilty, or no contest, I should say, to the charges. So he was ordered to pay any lump sum payments to the Levins, and as well 10% of his wages, until the amount would be paid in full, which of course it never would. In a note Chambers wrote to the court, he said, quote, "I elect not to contest the action for damages brought against me by the Levins. My only wish is for the nightmare to end for both families and friends. I do not wish the Levins to endure any more pain." Well, fuck off, Robbie. Did mommy help you write that? Fuck her, too. The Levins only had a nightmare because of you and the fact that you couldn't compensate for your dehydrated raisin of a penis, so you can take your letter and shove it. Robert Chambers' first request for parole was denied, partly because Jennifer Levin's mother told the parole board, quote, "In my eyes, anything less than the maximum would devalue my daughter's life." To that, I say amen, sis. The parole board denied his release in 1992 because they believed Chambers would most likely break the law if he was paroled. This is some major foreshadowing, y'all. Chambers expressed no remorse at his 1994 parole hearing. It amazes me he's having parole hearings this early. According to the transcript from the hearing, which is public record, Robert Chambers said, quote, "I guess I could also give you the party line and say I have learned my lesson. I will never do this again. But that's not how I feel at this moment because I have a lot of conflicting emotions." Aw, my heart aches for your emotions. Oh, poor Robert Chambers. I have an emotion, too. If headbutting your clown nose and watching you choke to death on your own venomous blood is an emotion, is that an emotion? What a jackass. Chambers spent 15 years in prison. 1,592 days of that were in solitary confinement for committing 30 serious offenses while behind bars. As he is behind bars, he's constantly testing positive for drugs. Prison guards are finding heroin and weed in his cell. He had problems completing college courses and the drug rehab program. I guess he regularly fought with prison guards and other inmates. That just kills me because usually, I don't know, you'd think he'd be a target. I don't understand why an inmate didn't just end it right there. Yeah, he's a big dude, but he's a coward. In 1988, just months before Robert Chambers was sent to prison for killing Jennifer Levin, he was given 90 days in solitary confinement when a corrections officer discovered a modified straight razor in his locker. So all of these offenses began way back when, and it continued. After Chambers pled guilty to killing Jennifer Levin, that idiot girlfriend Sean Covell stayed with him and visited him weekly until he was released in 2003 after serving only 15 years in prison. Upon release, he and Sean Covell lived in Georgia for several months before they returned to a Manhattan apartment. I have no idea how an ex-con notorious like this can get a Manhattan apartment. I just don't get it. But they're together. Over a 3-year period, God's Mistake was arrested multiple times for drug charges until 2007, when he and Sean Covell were charged with selling cocaine and heroin out of their home on East 57th Street. So he murdered an innocent young girl, went to prison, got released early. Well, it's so shocking that he went right back to a life of crime. While Sean Covell, the idiot girlfriend, pled guilty and was given probation after she agreed to enter drug treatment programs, Robert Chambers initially pled not guilty by reason of insanity to criminal sale of a controlled substance. He also admitted to using as many as 12 bags of heroin a day. I've known so many people that have overdosed, and they were good people. 12 bags a day, and this fuckstick's still living. Oh, and reason, not guilty by reason of insanity? Screw yourself. You talk about the perfect Patrick Bateman American psycho sociopath. I have to wonder if some of it was based on Robert Chambers. He was an absolute sociopath. According to Chambers, he became addicted to drugs when he was just 14, so his judgment and brain had been damaged by more than 2 decades of abusing narcotics. You know what I did in my 20s when I did blow? I stayed up super late and I partied. I didn't kill girls half my size, you daft cow. And another thing, 2 decades of doing narcotics, well, you just admitted that you continuously did drugs in prison. You need to be back in prison. You would have done drugs for not even 10 years. If you were a normal person, you would have went to prison, had no access to it, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, you are responsible, Robert Chambers, no one else. On September 2nd of 2008, Robert Chambers was sentenced to 19 years and 4 months behind bars for drug charges, as opposed to the 15 years for strangling Jennifer Levin to death. Weird, the New York media did not drug shame him. I guess only dead female victims get chewed up by the New York press. I guess that's the thing. If you're a woman in New York City and you've ever had sex, be aware, because if you die, you know, you had it come and it was your fault, I guess. That's according to the media there. Robert Chambers is currently serving nearly 20 years in prison for selling drugs and is eligible for parole on January 25th of 2024. But let's face it, creeps, he's a loser by choice. And if he gets out, he'll go right back in. The only thing I can say is that this thunder cunt will never live a real life. This is the same sentence he had no business opposing on Jennifer Levin. Oh, his longtime girlfriend Sean Covell ended their relationship. I don't know, maybe she got a date with a more impressive criminal like Ed Kemper or Charlie Manson. If the insult to humanity is granted parole in 2024, Chambers will be 57 years old when released, which means he will have spent more than half of his life behind bars. Gee, I'd sure hate if he looked at some psycho inmate the wrong way before then. That would be tragic. So fuck Robert Chambers. He's a wannabe, never was, wet noodle endowed herpes sore. I choose to remember Jennifer Levin and the spirit of goodness she brought to the world. In death, she had to fight for her reputation. She had to fight against this monster, and she had to fight against a slut-shaming New York City media who, if those writers are still around, have no business ever discussing the Me Too movement or anything like that. Levin's two best friends, Jessica Doyle and Peter Davis, describe the young woman that Jennifer was becoming before this tragic incident. Quote, "Jennifer kind of thought our lives were super cool," says Davis. "We lived uptown and we were already ingrained and enmeshed in this world." Creeps, there's a difference in uptown and New York was just a crazy, amazingly cultural place to be at the time. Jennifer Levin was a rich kid, but she was trying to experience all that the city had to offer. "She was playful and uninhibited," says Doyle. "She was open. She was all in, as we now say." Her two best friends described how they'd three-way call each other, which, yes, kids, that was a thing we did with our phones back in the day. That was high technology with the house phone. But they would three-way call each other and talk for hours about everything and anything.
from 1985's Hurricane Gloria to their inside jokes. Things like shouting out snossages, which was a code word for everything. "It's completely random," says Doyle of the snossages. "None of us had dogs." So it's just like all of us and our friends. We have our inside jokes, our stupid words, whatever. I'm painting you the picture that Jennifer Levin was nothing like this press described her or the piece of garbage as Robert Chambers treated her. "She was not a jaded person," Doyle remembers. "She really fully enjoyed the beauty of New York, the friendships that she made." As you can see, creeps, Jennifer Levin was your friend, your sister, your daughter, and she was denied the chance to continue being these things by an overprivileged footnote in history. Let's end with this. Jennifer Levin is not lost in vain, not by a long shot. At the time, justice for Jennifer demonstrations were everywhere, in particular outside the courtroom. They erupted during Chambers' trial. Buttons with that slogan became commonplace around New York. Take Back the Night, a feminist organization that had been staging anti-sex crimes events since the mid-70s, joined the cause. And Jennifer Levin became an icon for protests against what would become known as rape culture. I think it's fair to say that her tragic death probably ended up saving lives to this day. In the years since the preppy murder case, Take Back the Night has expanded into a global phenomenon. Marches and demonstrations are especially effective and attention-grabbing on college campuses. Young women who now are around Jennifer Levin's age when she was killed have picked up that torch and furthered the momentum. The Riot Girl movement of the early 90s, some of you might remember, it combined Take Back the Night camaraderie and strategy with politically charged punk rock. Jennifer Levin, who in life probably was as far removed from, quote, punk as possible, she spurred this new tenacious group of voices demanding an end to victim blaming and, of course, slut shaming. In 2011, friend Sonia Barnett and Heather Jarvis heard about a York University public safety lecture that included a police constable saying, quote, "Women should avoid dressing like sluts in order not to be victimized." York University is in Canada, by the way, which is why I use the word constable. So, these two friends overheard this, Barnett and Jarvis did. With a symbolic middle finger, the Toronto natives organized the first slut walk, which is a now famous march in which women paraded through the streets to the local police station while wearing outfits ranging from formal wear to office outfits down to bikinis or just body paint. And this is done in order to make the point that clothing in no way invites or excuses harassment or assault. Ironically, in Levin's case, she did not dress promiscuously, but point being, this spurred this whole thing, this men's entitlement to do things to women. The event went viral via social media, and slut walks now occur all over the world. The disgusting truth that Jennifer Levin had to be brutally killed to kickstart this liberation is supremely tragic and sad, and it holds a place in my heart, in my psyche, and I carry it with me all the time. And I'm just, a 40-something-year-old man. So I can only imagine how the case must be for some women out there.
But the fact that her memory carries on through good trouble, that continues to raise awareness, change norms, and take back the narrative, is awe-inspiring. That, my friends, my creeps, is the legacy of Jennifer Levin. And I will never give the killer the dignity of even speaking his name ever, ever again. Well, creeps, that was my first true crime book and case that caught my attention way back in the day. I hope I did the case justice. You can probably sense how impassioned I was. I didn't do... It was mostly humor-free, unlike a lot of the episodes, because, again, it's a very personal case to me. The media was such trash, I can't even... I don't know, really. I couldn't find anything if their feet were ever held to the fire. It was all kinds of media that slut-shamed Jennifer. But if you want to, it doesn't matter. There's no statute of limitations on murder. So they murdered her reputation after she was murdered. If you want to know, the biggest perpetrators were the New York Post and the New York Daily News. So, from time to time, I'll send them basically a fuck you letter, more formal, of course. Feel free to do so. Check out my Twitter because I've got the actual images on there. It's disgusting. So, thanks again, everybody who's been helping the show, the wonderful patrons or Patreons or whatever you're called. If you would like to be wonderful like these people, you can do so by going to patreon.com/creepycrawl. Easiest way would be on Venmo at jonathan-allen-154. Of course, follow me on the Bluebird at writer John Allen, no H, boy band spelling. Again, I'll post a lot of pictures that kind of help tie the case together, that sort of thing. Today's imaginary outro music is No Vaseline by Ice Cube. It's dedicated to the coward that I will not mention again. I think the song is self-explanatory, but if you haven't heard it, fire up the Google machine or hit up Spotify. Until next time, stay away from guys with pop collars and that undeserved sense of accomplishment. Fuck the New York media. And Creepy Crawl on.